This is The Film File, the film show for film geeks by film geeks. Parental warning, don't be a parent. Hello and welcome to The Film File. I'm Lee Ford.
And I'm Andy Meakin.
And welcome to our little old podcast, something that we love to do on a Sunday. Anyway, let's talk about what's going to be on this show. Let's talk about what's not going to be on this week, because we made a decision, didn't we?
Yes. So as people who follow us over on Facebook will know, I posted out a message the other day after watching a certain film saying we were negative last week about a film. And we said last week that we don't like to be negative.
No.
You know, that's not what we're here for. We're here to talk about like what's great about films. And even when we look at films that are bad as deep dives, like Sucker Punch, we always draw like positive things from it and what we can see that actually works in it. So after doing First Omen last week and neither of us really liking it, when I watched Rebel Moon Part 2 this week, I thought, I don't want to review this on the show because it's terrible. And so we're not giving it a full review. It's worse than the first one is all that I'm going to end on. So we've made the conscious decision that we're going to focus on films that we either half enjoyed or thoroughly enjoyed. And I think we've got some good ones this week.
We should, in all.
But it's not the worst film that I've seen this week. Because there's a bit of good news this week is that I'm probably never going to mention Paul Blart Mall Cop as being the worst film I've ever seen again.
Blimey, Charlie.
I was recommended one of the funniest films of last year, according to one of our members of our team at the cinema, Smotherhood. So I watched it, and boy, that was a painful experience. So from now on, Smotherhood is now the lowest standard for filmmaking. It's tragically bad. Adam Deacon is a triple threat, as in he can't act, he can't direct, and he can't write. He's threatening the film industry by actually having a presence within it.
Well, I'll never watch it. Let's give it a week. Let's talk about Rebel Moon, because I think there is a lot to unpack with it. And I don't want to be accused of being negative about Zack Snyder, because we have been in the past. And I think that's something that we ought to discuss, because we're not negative about Zack Snyder. And there are Zack Snyder movies that we like. I think there's something bigger that we need to talk about on this. But we'll address Rebel Moon, Scargiver, Rebel Moon Part 2 at some point. And apparently there's going to be a third film, so which is going to be called even more wheat. If anybody's ever seen Woody Allen's Love and Death, there's a scene about wheat, which that's what came to mind while watching it. The scene from Woody Allen's Love and Death. Oh, my.
One of the reviews that we are going to be doing in the show, well, I'm going to be covering the show later, also ties into one of the best experiences I had at work this week. We had the Q&A screening of Swede Caroline, the new British mockumentary set within the world of marrow farming competitions that goes in all weird directions. Full review later in the show. But at the Q&A, we had the writer and director, but also Joe Hartley, the beloved Joe Hartley, British actress who got her first footing in films in Dead Man's Shoes.
Okay, yes.
Became well known to the British public through her work as Cynthia in the This Is England film and TV series, and has just delivered great character after great character in everything that she's done. And she was one of the most engaging, personable stars and celebrities that I've ever had the pleasure to meet in my life. It was a great Q&A with all three of them together, like a good bit of jokes going on. We're just having a good chat around things. I had feedback at the end from like some of the people in the audience, like how well it all went, and they were really impressed with how I'd hosted it, which was made me just feel really on fire. But two of the guests who were in the audience were two of the other stars from This Is England. So half the team at the cinema were having palpitations all night at three people. Because even though it's not set in Sheffield, This Is England was filmed around Sheffield. Yeah. And so it's very beloved to a lot of the Sheffield population. And so everyone, like as soon as like Joe turned up, there was a few members of the staff who were like, oh, is that her? Is that her? And then she invited along Thomas Turgoose, who played Sean, and also Chanel Creswell, who played Kelly. And when they turned up, I'm telling you, the two of my bar team were ready to just collapse on the floor. But they were all three of them were just so likable. Tom just came up to me and like just didn't make the whole thing about introducing himself. He was like, "All right, buddy, how are you doing? What's things like? Oh, you great place here, is it?" And just started chatting. And when I said like some of my bar team are absolutely fangirling out and ready to collapse, he was like, "Oh, tell them to come over and say hello. They can get photos. Oh, fantastic. Love it. Marvelous people, absolutely marvelous. And having them telling me how well I hosted the Q&A, that was like, I should be blowing smoke up your asses. You shouldn't be blowing smoke up my asses. I was on cloud nine. It was a great Q&A. We've done some great Q&As over the past couple of years, but this is the one that I really came away with, and I've just been on high ever since. What a great night.
Great. Glad to hear it. So let's talk about this week's social challenge, because we set a tricky one, and historically, the tricky questions don't always mean that we're going to get a ton of answers. But last week in the social challenge, we spoke about what ifs. What if in alternative worlds, one film had done better than the other, or another one had failed, or we got the full version of rather than a director's cut? You know what I mean? A what if. Yeah.
Alternate castings or alternate directors or films that never got released that should have got released, that kind of thing. You know, those points in movie history that you think, this could have gone a completely different direction. Responses-wise, I mean, we knew this was a tricky one, so we weren't expecting a lot, but we did get a handful, and there's some really good answers within there. I'll start over at Facebook this week, where regular contributors, Owen Cooper and Lindsay Story, both chimed in. Owen started off by saying, "What if Andy liked Paul Blart?"
We wouldn't be doing this show. Simple as that.
Yeah, because if I liked Paul Blart, I clearly wouldn't have enough intelligence to be able to put together and edit anything. And so if we made a show, it'd just be me in a phone box somewhere phoning someone going, hello, I've watched films. That's what would happen if Andy liked Paul Blart.
I don't know where that accent came from. You suddenly became Welsh. Is that what would happen if you liked that movie?
I would turn Welsh.
You would become a Welsh person.
I mean, you can now say that Andy doesn't dislike Paul Blart as much as another film. So we're almost one step towards that reality. What if Zack Snyder made his films right the first time and didn't need different cuts or a fan campaign?
Ooh, controversial at the moment, really.
Owen's clearly playing into our hearts here. What if Marvel failed with Iron Man?
That's a good one. So let's think about it. They still had the Hulk in development, so the Hulk would have come out. The Hulk didn't set the world on fire. I guess they wouldn't have moved on with the Marvel Universe, or they would have tried probably to bring in Captain America a little bit earlier and not do an Iron Man 2 and see which one landed. But if by Captain America and Thor, there would have been no Avengers, and we wouldn't have got the huge superhero phenomena that we have now. We would have still had the occasional film, but we wouldn't have had the MCU. Certain.
Owen Port. But at the end of that, would we have gotten this oversaturation of superhero films now or other franchises trying to create extended universes? Now, comic book movies were successful before Iron Man because we'd had Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy. And I think we would have seen all superhero films going down that grounded realism route rather than, you know, Marvel went down the we're comic book, we're fantasy. DC tried and stumbled with the darker approach and then tried to retroactively pull things back. I think we would have just ended up with individual standalone character movies that aren't interlinked, but all of them going down a Daredevil-esque kind of grittiness.
So I think we would have still had comic book movies. I mean, Spider-Man was still very successful.
Yeah.
We would have had the reboot of Spider-Man, another reboot of Batman. We wouldn't have had the Snyder universe. We would have had just standalone movies.
Yeah.
But we wouldn't have had the sort of smaller characters, I don't think.
It would have just been already established names. Lindsay Story, all minor Johnny Depp what ifs. Apparently, studio bosses wanted to have Tom Cruise as Edward Scissorhands, but he wanted to change everything about the film. Also, how Bram Stoker's Dracula would have turned out with Johnny playing Dracula. Wow, that would have been weird.
I didn't know that one. That's an interesting what if.
And Chaplin, if he played the main part instead of Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, I think. Depp as Chaplin would have worked and probably given him an Oscar nom.
Lindsay also said, I'd love to have seen him in The Invisible Man. And last but not least, what if I really like Donnie Darko? Maybe if it was Johnny Darko. As as Lindsay's mentioned a few times, she doesn't understand why we all love Donnie Darko. And we're fine with that. We're fine with you not liking Donnie Darko, Lindsay. You're wrong, but we're absolutely fine with it. Over on Mastodon, we had a couple of answers. Rollo Treadway. I know it's a very obvious one, but Orson Welles' Heart of Darkness.
So that is a good question. What if Orson Welles had adapted Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness? Well, it was going to be his first film, but he had to cancel, stop making it due to budget constraints. The studio asked for Welles to create a much more conventional project. So he suggested a B film of his exploration of newspaper tycoon's rise and downfall, and he called it Citizen Kane. So he wouldn't have made Kane, as simple as that, and therefore probably his follower would have been The Magnificent Ambersons. So that would have changed film history, and if Heart of Darkness hadn't been a success, then we wouldn't have had one of the greatest films of all time.
Also, Rollo would like an alternative world where Buster Keaton had been allowed to make whatever films he liked in the sound era.
Oh, I've been a Buster Keaton fan. That would have been fantastic, because basically sound ended his career.
Rob Christopher over on Mastodon. Buñuel was going to direct The Loved One. Damn, I would have loved to have seen that.
That would have been a very interesting film.
And over on X Twitter, Imran said, I do wonder if Steven Spielberg had ended up directing Dial of Destiny, would it have been a bigger hit?
I'm not sure. I think it would have been a better film. And we didn't hate upon Dial of Destiny here at the Film File. But what we both agreed on when we came out of the viewing is it lacked the Spielberg touches.
Yeah.
Not that, nothing to take away from Mangold, but it lacked the Spielberg touches. And I think it would have been a better reviewed film if Spielberg had done it, but I don't necessarily think it would have been a hit. That's a good one. I like that one.
And over on Spotify, the Youngs replied with, what if Joaquin Phoenix had died and River Phoenix had lived?
Ooh, that's interesting. I don't know where to go with that one. I think I don't think River would have got Joaquin Phoenix's roles.
No, because he was a very different kind of actor.
Yeah, and much more sort of a young leading man. I think he would probably have had more of Johnny Depp's career. I think they would have been working against each other. And not to say that it pushed Johnny Depp to the front, but I think they would have been competing for the same roles.
But it would have changed like aspects of casting on, you know, Joaquin Phoenix's films. I mean, Gladiator, yes, Russell Crowe is memorable in that, but that film is mostly memorable because of Phoenix's performance as the villain in it.
Yeah.
You can't see other people in that role. So it would have changed the dynamic of what films were hits that Joaquin Phoenix was connected to. Would we have had that Joker film of recent years? Don't think so. I don't think we'd have had it at all. So thank you to the Youngs for that one. And to round off the suggestions from other people, IMD Bartlett on Twitter said, as great as Christopher Lloyd is, I'd have loved to have seen Tim Curry as Judge Doom in Roger Rabbit. Apparently, the reason he wasn't cast was because his audition terrified Robert Zemeckis.
I didn't know that.
We all love Christopher Lloyd in that film. We all love Christopher Lloyd anyway. But Tim Curry, bringing some of his kind of edgy zaniness, would have been a completely different character. So that's we weren't expecting a lot of responses this week because we did pose a difficult question. I've got a few that I wanted to...
Yeah, go on then.
So the obvious one is, what if the William Gibson version of Alien 3 had gone to film?
That's interesting, because we wouldn't have had Sigourney Weaver return. So that would potentially have meant that if there had been a 4 after that one, that could have brought Weaver back. We would have had a very, very different run for Alien 4.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, it changed the game, and it's a great script, and there's a fantastic comic adaptation of that script, which is worth checking out. But it would have taken the franchise in a different direction. I think it would have been successful, and probably more successful than the Alien 3 that we had, because it was a lot more visceral than the film that we got. And that's not to take anything away from Fincher's film.
From my point of view, is that it would have been the better direction to go in to expand out the Alien franchise and not just be repetitive. Because Alien 3, it's not as bad as some people make out. I mean, it's flawed, but it is just more or less trying to do a retread of things that we've already seen. Whereas Gibson's script would have, you know, done what Aliens did to Alien and just take the basic concept, but have a different feel of a film completely. And it would have been great to see the Alien franchise always have different approaches and never feel repetitive. We might start to see that with the upcoming reboot of the franchise in film and TV series format. Let's hope, eh? There's the casting of Eric Stoltz in Back to the Future. How would have that panned out?
Well, they would have had to keep shooting with Eric Stoltz, knowing that it wasn't working.
There are the clips that you can find on the DVDs and Blu-ray releases of some of the Eric Stoltz aspects. I don't think it had been a huge success like the first one was.
That is lightning in a bottle filmmaking, because they always wanted Michael J. Fox. Couldn't get him because of his TV commitment initially. I think they'd have had to have kept filming with Stoltz and hoped to put it together in post. Now, would it have been a very different film? Not to take anything away from Stoltz as a good leading man, but Michael J. Fox just had the right amount of charm. So it would have been a very different, or probably a slightly less comedic Back to the Future than what we got. More of an adventure story than a comedy adventure.
And then you've got the famous, what if we had have got the Nicolas Cage Superman Lives movie?
Oh, that's a great one. So Tim Burton was going to direct it. Nicolas Cage was lined up to star as Superman. They were going in a very, very different direction. They were talking about Robert Downey Jr., funny enough, to play Lex Luthor. If it had been a success, then we would have had a sequel. If it had been a flop, then I think we'd have probably gone back to doing what we did anyway, which was waiting for another Batman franchise and waiting for time and waiting to reintroduce Superman at a later stage. We certainly wouldn't have had Superman Returns.
There's a great documentary out there which delves into the death of Superman Lives that is well worth checking out. It came out about 8 years ago, the documentary. And anyone who just thinks, oh, that would have been ridiculous, once you've watched that documentary, you go, actually, that could have been something special. And it could have put DC firmly on the map as the forerunners of the superhero genre for this century. If that had been a success, DC would be in such a better place than what they are right now. And Marvel would be clamoring to catch up with DC. Would have changed the game completely if it had come out and wowed audiences in the same way that Tim Burton did when he made Batman.
So a couple for me. What if Star Wars had failed? Not failed because of the film had been any good, but 20th Century Fox didn't believe in it. Their big film for that particular year was going to be Damnation Alley. That was the big sci-fi film that they were pushing. I don't think Star Wars would have failed, even in the alternate, if they threw more money into Damnation Alley, because Damnation Alley is not that great a film. So special effects-wise, Star Wars blew it out of the water. But there wouldn't have been a sequel. We would have been talking about Star Wars as a lost classic, the film that should have found an audience.
I think on the back of that idea, if Star Wars had failed, I don't think we'd have got Indiana Jones.
No.
We wouldn't have got Blade Runner, because Harrison Ford wouldn't have suddenly become a huge name. I think it would have had a huge impact on, because after Star Wars, cinemas each year were showing the latest sci-fi blockbusters. And through the 80s, it became sci-fi blockbusters to action adventures. And I think that whole run through the 80s of building like the big tentpole movie, I don't think it had hit.
Yeah, we'd have had lots of different science fiction films. We'd have carried on the roots of your Logan's Runs and Soylent Greens and those kind of standalone science fiction films without thinking of sequels. We wouldn't have had sort of universe building, and Star Wars would become a cult classic that would have found recognition in time, even if it didn't find it. A bit like Wonderful Life through TV viewings and a fan base. We would have had a TV version of Star Trek, because we wouldn't have had the Star Trek films because of that. We wouldn't have had all the Italian ripoffs, and we wouldn't have had Battlestar Galactica. But the next thing would have landed that we would have been a big hit, but it would have changed some of blockbusters forever. There would have been a little bit more cerebral. We would still have had Close Encounters. So Spielberg would be the biggest filmmaker still for the 70s and 80s. But George Lucas would probably have gone back to making small, more independent films like American Graffiti and like THX 1138, as opposed to this big, big universe. I'm just going to introduce my last what if John Carter had been a hit. It's not a terrible movie. I think if they hadn't have been doing the transition into buying Fox, then Disney would have put more time and effort. I think there would have always been a John Carter movie if Star Wars had failed. I think maybe even earlier. But if John Carter had been a hit, we would have had a string of pulp heroes in the same way that we've had a lot of superhero movies. So we would have had a Doc Savage movie.
Yeah.
We would have had a return to those pulp movies until one failed. And as much as I love Doc Savage, pulp characters don't really resonate with modern audiences. Even though The Shadow was a great movie, it didn't resonate with modern audiences because most audiences had no idea who those characters are. So I think we would have had a couple of sort of pulp hero movies because John Carter had done so well. And we would have had a John Carter sequel, maybe two or three John Carter sequels.
Yeah.
Wow, that was good. That took us down some rabbit holes. Let's do this week's social challenge. And let's talk about perfect partnerships. Andy and I are a perfect partnership. We don't always agree. When we do agree, I think I think we all bring a very different perspective to things. And when we disagree, we understand why each other disagrees. I think that's what makes the film file work, because it's an interesting dynamic, it's an interesting partnership. So what we want to ask you this week is great movie partnerships, whether that's a director and an actor working together in tandem, on-screen partnerships like Redford and Newman, great partnerships, actors, producers, writers who work together really well to bring out the best in each other, and sometimes noticeable when they're working apart. Let us know by simply doing any of this.
Head over to social media channels, follow us, Filmfile UK is what you want to be looking for. We'll post out the questions sometime during the week, respond via there. Or you can email us the answer, podcast@filmfile.uk. Or if you're on Spotify, there'll be a version of the question of the week in the show notes that you can reply to directly through Spotify.
And that leads us nicely into what's happening on this week's show. We've got reviews into...
Opened at cinemas this week, we've got three new releases. We've got Sometimes I Think About Dying. We've got Swede Caroline, but we've got the one that both me and Lee saw together, which is Abigail.
We have a deep dive into the 1966 science fiction adventure film, Fantastic Voyage. But before any of that, we've got some news for you, and we've certainly got some box office. Is Abigail going to take a bite out of the Civil War, or is Civil War still fighting to stay on top? Andy, let us know.
So in the US, Civil War retained the top spot with 11.1 million. Abigail opened in second place with 10.3 million. Godzilla X Kong is in third place with 9.6 million. Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare on fourth with 8.9 million. And Spy X Family Code White, 4.8 million to round off the top five. Here in the UK, Back to Black stayed at the top spot with another 1.8 million added to his total. Civil War in second place, taking another million. Kung Fu Panda 4 still holding in there, taking another 901,000. Godzilla X Kong in fourth place, 652,000. And Abigail opened in fifth place, taking 596,000. Abigail has managed to do 15 million worldwide in its opening weekend, only cost 28 million to make. So it stands a good shot of creeping into profit towards the end of its run. Civil War is the interesting one because it's good to see that it's holding over quite well, because there was the worry with that film that it would be all top end heavy and then it would bottom out. And again, it's only a relatively low budgeted film. So I think it's going to be safe to say that this is going to be a financial success for them. Alex Garland stepping away from directing on a high point.
Yeah, I finally got a chance to see it. And if you want to know my thoughts, basically watch Andy's review, because we are absolutely, absolutely in agreement with everything on that. So let's talk about some news. Andy, what have you got?
So we've spoken a few times about Paramount's struggling finances and potentials for buyouts. Well, news came in this week that it looks like Sony Pictures are hovering around Paramount like vultures, ready to pick it apart. That sounds a bit more sinister than what it needs to be. But Sony Pictures Entertainment and investment firm Apollo Global Management are apparently in discussions about teaming up for a joint bid to acquire Paramount, according to the New York Times. They've not submitted an official bid with Paramount yet, and it's just conversations with Skydance, who they've had a working relationship with over the years. This might go through, but we know from past stories when we've spoken about potential buyouts of Paramount that it seems that Paramount are kind of brushing off anything that they don't think is an adequate bid, and then everyone's backing away because They are struggling, but they don't want to acknowledge how badly they're struggling. But it's only a matter of time before someone snaps it up. I mean, Paramount owns some great properties. The Star Trek properties, Top Gun, Mission Impossible, Transformers, SpongeBob, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Friday the 13th, the Jack Ryan franchises. They just don't seem to be doing much with most of them. Not enough to keep them going as their own company. So it is only a matter of time. Will Sony buy them out? Let's see.
Interesting days as we get less and less big studios. Has it had a considerable knock-on with Disney owning Fox? Fox lost their identity? Is it too early to see that? My fear would be is that if Sony took over Paramount, then they just become a subsidiary of Columbia.
Yeah, like you say, it becomes a worry that you have less studios. You don't have any standout identity. You could argue that Disney haven't interfered with the Searchlight branch of Fox, and that's still got its very, very much own identity. But standard Fox films don't feel any different to standard Disney films now. And we're not saying that in a negative way, because we're not the kind of people who start moaning about wokeism being forced into Disney properties, because it's not. It's just that there's no brand identity.
Yeah, and I think Paramount have got quite a unique brand identity.
Yeah, and with less studios, it means that they'll probably just all try to copy each other and all try to get the same feel. They'll look to see what works and all jump on the same bandwagon, because there'll be no outliers to go, well, we'll take risks. And, you know, Top Gun Maverick was a risk.
Yes.
Did we really need a sequel to a film that was kind of cheesy and it's got some fondness, but only for a generation who were there at the time? And it turned out to be a well thought through risk. It captured a modern audience. Will we still get that? We don't know. Other news, which is a continuing theme that we go back to every now and then, is the use of AI. Right. And this week, A24 and Netflix have come under fire for the use of AI. Now, okay, we know that over the past year, there's been Marvel's Secret Invasion did its opening credits and got a lot of flack for utilizing AI to create them. And it looked terrible, let's be honest. Recently, Late Night with the Devil was under fire because the title cards and some of the background artwork were created using AI artwork, which that's a whole discussion for another day. I've had discussions with filmmakers on this one, and they make very valid points. But A24 and Netflix came under fire this week because A24's Civil War campaign, their Instagram ad campaign for the film, was featuring images of a number of American landmarks destroyed by fictional civil wars within the film. And these aren't part of the film. They weren't filmed as the film. They used AI to generate them. A source for the trades says that those images were made only for the social channels. It wasn't made for the films. It was just like a part of the marketing campaign. It was a big what if. And so they wanted to continue that thought through the like social media aspect.
I can see why on social. I can see why.
Because it's quicker and easier. And, you know, on socials, you don't know how your posts are going to get responders. So you want something together. But there's still the argument is that, you know, someone could have been paid to do that. You could have even got a student to do it as some of their project work, which would have worked towards their grades. And just some of them would do it for free. Some would only charge a small amount. Now, that could be brushed off as unfortunate decision-making from a marketing department. But the more serious accusations this week were levied at Netflix in regard to its documentary, What Jennifer Did. It was reported earlier this week that Netflix used what strongly appears to be AI-generated or manipulated images in a recent documentary about a Canadian murder-for-hire plot involving a woman named Jennifer Pan. The photos of her pre-arrest are reportedly never labelled as being AI-generated either in the moments of the on-screen or in the credits, but they show clear signs of manipulation, which means that edited pictures are being presented as fact without actually acknowledging that they've been AI-tampered. And when you're looking at a true-life story, that's where you're stepping into dangerous territory.
I'm assuming that's leveled more at the production company than Netflix, who just paid for it. Because the production company are more responsible for that than Netflix itself. But yeah, on that one, I'm going to be in agreement with you totally on that one.
And on the subject of Netflix, there's been a bit of a shake-up over at Netflix. Their new film chief, Dan Lin, took over his role on April the 1st. And just 2 weeks in, he's begun shaking things up under his new regime. According to the New York Times, there's 15 people from the Creative Film Executive Group who have been cut and are now seeking other employment, including two directors and a VP. The film department is now organized by genre rather than budget level. And enormous upfront deals are out the window. So we'll no longer be reporting on stories, apparently, like securing deals with set directors, set creators, etc. I think they've stung themselves with Zack Snyder, let's be honest. The plan is now for a wider variety of films and a focus on improving the quality of said films. There's been a lot of criticism about Netflix films having a certain style and tone to them that doesn't give them identities. It also means less auto-driven vehicles showing up on the service. Hidden within that report is the news, and this was sad news, Catherine Bigelow's Project Aurora, which was in development for Netflix, has now been scrapped. Bigelow herself apparently left the project a few months ago, and now Netflix have completely knocked the whole idea on the head. It was going to be her first film since 2017, based on David Cope's book about characters coping with the collapse of social order.
Great book. Read it. Fantastic.
Coop was adapting the script himself. Whether Coop is now going to re-team with Bigelow and start pitching it around other houses remains to be seen. But I think it's a shame. It's not like Catherine Bigelow to step away from a project when she started on it. So clearly she came to a bit of a loggerheads with some Netflix creative decisions. Let's see whether this improves Netflix going forwards. Let's see if we start to see a difference.
Did you know, Andy, that Martin Scorsese is a big fan of the Film File? And I say that because we ran a social challenge a couple of weeks ago when we talked about film biographies. Seems that Martin Scorsese, probably prompted by something you said, is now going to direct a Frank Sinatra biopic to potentially star Leonardo DiCaprio. And you said, Andy, there should be a Sinatra biopic. Apparently, Scorsese, a huge fan of the show, listened to what you said. So I think you need a producer's credit on this. And that seems to be his up-and-coming film.
Yeah, so Marty, thank you for listening to the show. When I suggested it as like, you know, because when I said Frank Sinatra, Lee had said, there's been Rat Pack films. Oh yeah, but there's been no Frank Sinatra one. I was like, yeah, and it's an interesting story. There's a huge amount that can be told about Frank Sinatra. And so you clearly heard me say that. And thank you. I look forward to seeing what you do with it because, yeah, you're a well-respected director. But yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio and Jennifer Lawrence are set to play Sinatra, with Jennifer Lawrence playing his second wife, actress Ava Gardner. It doesn't have the blessing of Tina Sinatra, who controls her father's estate just yet. So there's still that avenue to go down. But let's hope.
Big news this week is Quentin Tarantino. And apparently he scrapped his final film, which was going to be called The Movie Critic, with Brad Pitt returning to the Tarantino family. But what do we know about this, Andy? Is it going to be something else? Is he going to not make any more films? Why has he changed his mind?
No reporting has fully explained what's led to this. Preparations had begun to get ready to start shooting it only in a couple of months. We knew that this film was going to be set in 1977 California and drawing inspiration from a movie critic that would write great reviews for Skin Mags, which Tarantino read when he was growing up. And it was also going to have little elements of films of that era, but reshot. Along the way, the trades have said that the film morphed into something else, with Brad Pitt reprising his Cliff Booth character from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood instead. And then Tarantino's just had a change of heart again and is now apparently going to do something entirely different. This is probably because Tarantino himself has created a rod for his own back. When Kill Bill was coming out, he stated at that point in time that because they were moving to digital, everything was moving to digital, and he just wants to work with film. Because of the limited film stock that there is and how expensive it's getting, he was only going to make 10 films in total before he steps away from movie making. This will be a 10th film. And I think he's got himself into a corner now, and he doesn't want to backtrack and say, well, actually, I'm going to do 11 films, going to do 12 films. And he's still got four or five different ideas of films that he wants to make, and he can't decide which one to do. And I wouldn't be surprised if whatever project he announces on the back of this to be his 10th film, then gets to a certain stage and gets scrapped again as he goes, oh, well, actually, I'm going to go to this. We also know that he constantly throws out ideas because there was the proposed TV series spinning off Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
In Hollywood, yeah.
That's never materialized. I just think he can't nail down what that final story that he wants to tell is. We're just going to tread water until he finally delivers something, if he ever does.
He's pressed pause before. He pressed it on Hateful Eight, didn't he? Because there was a script leak. Yeah. And he held back on that and eventually went back to Hateful Eight, as we know. Interesting. We'll see where he goes with that one. But that's pretty big news for this week.
Other big news is Zack Snyder has threatened more Rebel Moon. I mean, he said that he's got ideas for up to 6 Rebel Moon films.
Well, spoilers that there's a suggestion of a third film by the time you get to the end of Scargiver.
Yes, it's pure sequel bait at the end of Scargiver to suggest the third film. But he said in an interview with the Radio Times this week, I guess 4 makes sense. 4 or 6 movies, depending. I guess it's whether or not every time we make one of these movies, we make 2. That's the question. Whether Netflix are going to see it, because we know that the first part of Rebel Moon had a really good first week for the streamer, but then swiftly bottomed out. And then the discussion, which they were expecting to continue going on the run-up to Scargiver, didn't happen. We need to wait to see what the streamer says this has done on its first week before we'll see whether there's any future for Snyder's Rebel Moon. We know it's been received even worse by critics and fans than the first part, and we know that we're not talking about it today on the show.
But Andy, Netflix have not really pushed this. It did get a week's cinema release at only, I think, 1 cinema in Los Angeles. I've not seen Netflix really push this in the same way that they pushed the first film. It's just sort of appeared this week to very little fanfare. I'm not going to say that it's over because I don't know anything or anything definitive, but I don't think we're going to get to see the universe that Snyder intended. But we'll wait and see.
Over in Superman world, the Kents have been cast.
Yes, I heard this.
Character actor Neva Howell, who you might remember from Logan Lucky, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, The Long Haul, reportedly has been cast as Martha Kent in James Gunn's Superman. And veteran character actor Pruitt Taylor Vince has been cast as Superman's adopted father, Jonathan Kent.
That's an interesting casting decision. That goes against type of the other Parr Kents that we've had previously.
Yeah, he's a great character actor who's been seen on film and television for decades. He was in JFK, Natural Born Killers, Jacob's Ladder, The Cell, Deadwood, Murder One, Bird Box, Drive Angry, Walking Dead. You've seen him everywhere. And as soon as he was cast, it was like, I wouldn't have ever thought of that one.
Yeah.
No one had that one on the bingo card. But my goodness, I can't wait to see what he brings to the role. This means that all the cast apparently are now secured for the film, which is entering it's in production and it's due out next year. And I couldn't be more excited. As a huge Superman fanboy, I can't be more excited to see this take on it.
Andy, are you a fan of the current Amazon Prime series Fallout? Have you played the games?
I am enjoying the series. Me and the wife are watching it week on, episode by episode. We're not binging it. Don't like to binge in this household. And I do like the games. I'm a fan of the games, so I'm enjoying it from a fan's perspective, but also as someone who just likes Jonathan Nolan's storytelling.
Well, you'd be pleased to know that Amazon Prime have jumped in with a second season.
Doesn't come as much of a surprise. The series already managed to get itself a $25 million tax credit to film a second season in California. A shift from the first season, which was shot mostly in New York and Utah. So they've got $25 million towards their budget for the next season anyway. So it was only a matter of time before they decided we'll throw in another $100 to $120 million and make a second season. It's been warmly received by critics and fans. There's only a handful of outliers out there who are being negative about it for various wokeism reasons. There's nothing woke about it at all. It's got a female lead character. That's the only thing that they're complaining about. But it's a great show. It captures the satire of the games. It captures the essence of the games. But you don't have to have understood the games to understand this because it's so well paced out.
So much so that Fallout is in Prime Video's top 3 most watched series ever and has been the service's biggest global hit since The Lord of the Rings. Series Ring of Power.
It's also resulted in the Fallout games suddenly having a huge spike in sales as well.
I've never played them. I'm tempted. I don't know where to jump in. Maybe someone could let me know.
Jump in with the third one.
Okay.
Because the first two are kind of isometric RPG adventures on the PC. They're good. I love them. But the third one is when it goes into the first-person control kind of setting that we're so familiar with that kind of game these days. We've got some little bites of quick news to run through before we've got a couple of trailers to talk about. So first of all, Wes Anderson's next feature, which is currently shooting in Berlin, has now added Riz Ahmed to the cast roster. This is Riz Ahmed's first involvement in an Anderson film. As we expect, it's going to be a typical Anderson film with an ensemble of a myriad of character actors coming along. We are expecting to see Bill Murray finally come back after he couldn't be in Asteroid City due to other commitments at the time. Pamela Anderson is joining the Naked Gun reboot, which is in the works at Paramount.
Which stars Liam Neeson. There you go. Wondering what Liam Neeson was doing next. That's what he's doing.
And as we said before, anyone who's turning the nose up at this idea of a project, bear in mind, Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers writers Dan Greger and Doug Mand are reuniting with Akiva Schaffer for this project. And they did well with that Chip and Dale movie. That was a lot of fun. If they could tap into that kind of fun energy for the Naked Gun, this could be well worth doing.
Yeah, it was much more fun than it deserved to be.
Now, this is another one of those that you think no one had that on their bingo card. But now that it's been mentioned, why did no one have it on their bingo card? Shadow, in the upcoming third Sonic the Hedgehog film, is going to be voiced by Keanu Reeves. And I can't think of anything more perfect. TV-wise, Korean filmmaker Park Chan-wook and Lionsgate are teaming up to develop an English-language TV version of his iconic 2003 South Korean revenge thriller Old Boy. The series plans to be a new adaptation of the story. If you imagine what they've done with Snowpiercer when they readapted that and made a TV series out of it and made it become its own energy, think that, but with Old Boy, because Old Boy itself came from a manga of the same name. So there's potential for that to work, especially when the original creator is behind the scenes. And Brad Dourif is stepping away from films, except to voice Chucky. He's 74. Brad Dourif's 74.
I know. And
wow.
I can always just picture it. Probably his first screen role in One for the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yes, he got the Best Supporting Actor nomination for that role. And ever since then, he's always been a go-to for genre films and has rarely, rarely not been working through the years. But yeah, he's only going to voice Chucky from this point onwards. He feels that his time in front of the camera is done.
The showrunners behind Netflix's sadly failed Cowboy Bebop live-action series, Josh Applebaum, Andre Nemec, they are penning Disney's movie adaptation of their ride, Space Mountain. And it's something Disney have done before. Jungle Cruise, Haunted Mansion, and of course, Pirates of the Caribbean.
There's been a couple of trailers, not a lot of trailers this week, but there was two that stood out for me.
Trailer light, hasn't it?
Yeah. But the two that stood out for me, first of all, there's Transformers 1, which you know I'm a big Transformers fan.
Yeah.
You know I love the old comic books. I've got mixed thoughts with this one. Because Transformers 1, it's an animated movie, and I love the animation design. I think it's slick. I think it's polished. It looks like early Transformers, but done really modernly. But it's an origin story for Optimus and Megatron from before they became Optimus Prime and Megatron. And at the same time, it's like a buddy cop movie approach where the two of them actually work together and are actually like quite friendly before they became opposing factions. Now, I like the aspect of that. I like the whole idea that something splintered them, because we've seen it done well in X-Men. But in the trailer for this, it seemed to lean too much into the comedy, and I'm not too sure how I feel about that with Transformers. I feel that Transformers needs to be a bit more serious. It might just be that the trailer has deliberately just picked out the few comedic moments of the film in order to try to get a general audience to go, oh, this isn't going to be bogged down in lore and stuff. It's going to be fun. But for me, as a fan of Transformers, it's left me a bit unsure. I still will see it because I'm a big Transformers fan. But this first trailer hasn't quite worked for me as a fan.
And then lastly?
Did you catch the trailer for M. Night Shyamalan's Trap?
I did. Now, there's been some controversy because apparently, or seemingly, it gives away a twist that really perhaps should have been kept under wraps. I don't think they've given the twist that we think they've given away. Because
I don't think they have.
We know that M. Night Shyamalan works very well with twists. Anyway, the movie stars Josh Harner, yes, he of Sin City. Halloween H2O, that's back in the day. A father and teen daughter attend a pop concert when they realize they're at the center of a dark and sinister event.
This is one of those trailers that had all the markings of an M. Night Shyamalan film. Something looks like normal, everyday events, going to a pop concert with your daughter, getting ready for fun, but then realizing there's something going on, and then finding out that the concert has been set up as a sting operation to draw out a serial killer. And that's the point at which people are saying it's giving away the twist, because it then seems to focus heavily on Josh Hartnett, But I think that's misdirection.
Yeah.
I think I know what the twist is on this, but I'm not going to say it because I don't want to spoil it for people. But I think I know what the actual twist is going to be. Well, I've said it before. M. Night Shyamalan, I might not thoroughly enjoy his films these days, but the fact that he's self-funding and he's making his own projects, I think it's interesting. I always find his films interesting, even though they tend to over-explain stuff these days because he doesn't really know how to edit himself down enough. But I will always be there for an M. Night film because I'm always interested to see what he brings to the table.
And that, folks, that's the news for this week. You're listening to The Film File, the film show for film geeks by film geeks. And if you haven't already subscribed, please do so by heading over to your favorite podcast platform, leaving a like, and remember to hit that subscription button. You can get in touch with us by
social media channels, Film File UK. We're mostly prominent on Facebook, Twitter, Mastodon, and Blue Sky. Or you can email us podcast@filmfile.uk. Love to hear from you. Love to hear thoughts on film.
Now it's time for this week's deep dive.
Dive, dive, dive.
Film directed by Richard Fleischer. It's a fantastic voyage.
The eye of man is ever seeking, leading him ever onward to explore the vastness of space, the depths of the seas, the bowels of the earth. Now, you are going on a journey through the living body of man. Fantastic Voyage takes you where no film has ever been before.
One of the miracles of the universe.
No eyewitness has actually seen what you will see. But in this world of ours, where going to the moon will soon be upon us, and where the most incredible things are happening all around us, someday, perhaps tomorrow, the fantastic events that you will view can and will take place.
24 seconds left. After that, you're in danger of attack.
Fantastic Voyage!
When a brilliant scientist from behind the Iron Curtain, in an assassination attempt, develops a blood clot on the brain that is going to kill him. The scientist Benz is utilizing technology developed that can miniaturize matter. So a team of scientists and experts in a submarine enter into his bloodstream in order to save him. The film starred Stephen Boyd, Edmund O'Brien, the great Donald Pleasant, Arthur Kennedy, and it was the first big screen appearance for an actress who made a sizable impression. Yes, Rachel Welch. This, as a kid, was a film that my dad showed me. Back in the day, I would wait until whichever channel would show it again so I could fall in love with this film all over again. Who couldn't love a film about a submarine and a crew shrunk to microscopic size and venture into a body to repair a damage to the patient's brain? That film is so me. And I sat down and I passed this on to the kiddo. And I thought I made a great mistake because it does take its time to get going. But once you enter into the body and into the voyage, this film is still a roller coaster ride.
It's a film that, I mean, lots of films of that era have that slow build up before it actually gets to the core of the story. But once they get injected into the body, it then becomes a wonderfully visual spectacle of a film, and you really start to really believe in this journey that they're taking through the human body. It's helped by the fact that the director had studied medicine and anatomy before he made his move to filmmaking, so he wanted to represent the inner workings of the body as close to believable, but giving them that sci-fi sheen of majestic wonderment. And he even had medical experts working on it to make sure that things kind of make sense, that if they're going from one passage to another, that would track. But overall, for me, I watched this like you at an early age. It was my mum who first put this on for me. And I used to keep a lookout for it coming back on TV again so I could watch it again. And when we got our first VHS player, this was one of the first films that I recorded so I could watch it whenever I could. Visually, even the outside the body elements, is everything that I love about this era of sci-fi, where you've got great big data banks with like flashing lights and spinning tapes, but it's all symmetrical. Every room is kind of symmetrical, and the symmetry and the color palettes, you know, all the cabinets are gray, but there's occasional streaks of yellow or browns. It all looks absolutely crisp, absolutely sexy. And this is the kind of future that I dreamed of living in, this future world. I'm disappointed that my world does not look like this.
It's got a great look. You're absolutely right. One of the things that blew me away watching it again, and it's been many years since I've seen Fantastic Voyage, and that was the scale of the film, the scale of the design, the sets, the huge sets. Very clever that they're all intertwined to a degree that you can carry on with one camera shot from one location to the other location. And I'm thinking about the environment where the control center is. It's got that fantastic 60s view of what the futuristic was all about. And exactly like you, that is the future that I wanted to live with. It's a film that was incredibly well received for its special effects. It had 5 nominations at the 39th Academy Awards, mostly in technical departments, and it did win for Best Visual Effects and Best Direction in Color. Now, there's an award that's now out the window, but it still holds up. Yes, the effects now are a little shaky, but this is a film that's nearly 60 years old. But the story and the idea behind it are absolutely fascinating. The submarine, the Proteus, which is miniaturized to about the size of a microbe, is injected into the scientist's body. The design of the submarine is fantastic, an icon, and I don't think I had, but I would have loved a model version of it in my room, and that would have been absolutely perfect. It's got a cast where, okay, now some of it seems a little bit obvious. Raquel Welch's character is in one shot. She's the only character who dons her scuba diving gear to camera, which I thought was a little bit plain. But apart from that, everything holds up remarkably well. There are some scenes and set designs which are absolutely still jaw-dropping.
And it's also interesting as well with the music used in this film, because Leonard Rosenman did a score for it, but he did no music for the first 4 reels. The music only kicks in once they're injected into the human body, and that's when it becomes part of the magic of the traversing through bloodstreams and, you know, ear canals, etc. That scene in the ear canal is so tense. Yes. I remember as a kid watching that and just being, you're holding your breath because they have to do some repairs to the submarine craft. Basically, they've got clogged up engines and they have to go outside the vessel while they're in the ear canal. And then it cuts outside to the control room where they say it needs to be utter silence within there, because even the slightest sound could destroy them while they're in the air canal. And you don't want to breathe yourself because you're worried that you're going to cause them to have something go wrong. And it's just such tense stuff without any real major threat. The threat is the human body itself trying to fight off anything that shouldn't be there. And obviously the submarine has to be careful not to alert the human body that it's infiltrating the bloodstream. It has got an underlying threat of there may be a traitor in the mist, which does play through quite well, even though it's pretty obvious who the traitor's going to be.
Yeah, and he's not really a traitor, is he?
No, he's
slightly misunderstood. It's not revealed that he works for the other side. It's more to do with fear. That was my take.
He's at the start of the whole thing, he panics and almost tries to flee and almost destroys it because he suffers from elements of claustrophobia. But yeah, it just plays out as an imaginative and creative sci-fi venture into the human body. And I just love everything about this film. Rewatching it this week in crisp, beautiful glory was such an eye-opener for me, because this is one of those films that I've always had at the back of my mind and thought, maybe now that I'm a little older, this is not going to hold up. But I'm glad to say that it did. Even the effects work, I think, yeah, they look dated, but it's still, because you're inside the human body, and none of us have shrunk down that size to be inside the human body, you accept it. You accept that that's how it looks. You caught up by this this strange cell-like structure wall of the ear canal that has little symbols on each thing. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. I like to think that it actually does. I like to think that that's what the inside of my body looks like. If you've never seen Fantastic Voyage, I can't recommend it enough. Now, I know that most people will have seen a film that was heavily inspired by Fantastic Voyage. Which
you're talking about Inner Space, aren't you?
Yes. The Martin Short comedy with Dennis Quaid, Inner Space, which had apparently elements that were drawn from a proposed potential sequel that Asimov was writing for the novelizations of Fantastic Voyage, which would have seen like East and West, like both being injected into the same body and trying to fight for control of some what one person's body. And Inner Space kind of does that towards the last act of the film. Inner Space is another great example of like being creative and adventurous. I don't think it's anywhere near as good as Fantastic Voyage.
No.
But it's an utter joy to watch because of the comedy performance from Martin Short and the more seriousness of Dennis Quaid's character as the pilot who's stuck within the body of an unassuming guy who gets injected rather than a rabbit. It's Joe Dante as director on Inner Space that makes it feel fresh, imaginative, and doesn't feel like it's just a carbon copy of Fantastic Voyage. But Fantastic Voyage itself, it's such a great 60s era sci-fi film that is, I think it's one of the best of that era. And there were some great films of the 60s.
I've got to agree. I think a lot of that is down to Richard Fleischer, who brought us the brilliant still. One of the most visually imaginative films of all time is 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea for Disney. And he brings verisimilitude to the film. It makes the film, no matter how preposterous the idea of miniaturization is, he makes the film feel real. Now, at one point, and I didn't know this was an interesting fact, it was positioned as a sequel in the Derek Flint spy movie series, which stars James Coburn. And I love the Flint movies. But I'm so glad that they went in their own direction on this one. There have been talks for many years at one point of a sequel, as Andy mentioned. There have been talks of a reboot with James Cameron connected to it for an awful long time. He's interested in directing the film. He's been interested since 1997. And we mentioned on this show, it's still something he wants to do. He left it behind to go and focus on Avatar. Roland Emmerich at one point was connected to do it. Thank goodness that never happened. Paul Greengrass, even Sean Levy have all intended to make a version of Fantastic Voyage. Eventually, you know what? There will be. But in the meantime, I insist, get small. Check out this film because it is marvelous.
Do you remember the animated series?
I do, yeah. with a character called Captain Kidd, who was the captain of the Proteus. Would look like a pirate. It bared very little resemblance apart from the submarine.
Yeah, I have strange fond memories of watching the animated series one summer. And yeah, it had nothing to do with the original Fantastic Voyage except that they were injected into the body of a human. But they had 12 hours this time instead of 1 hour before it grew back. And on the subject of it growing back, now I mentioned that Asimov was working on a sequel novel to it because he did the novelization of the film. And he initially didn't want to do it because he thought that some of the science in it was preposterous. And he wanted to correct what he saw as glaring omissions in the logic of the film. And the main one that he tackled was after the end of the hour, when they enlarge and they have to get out of the body. Otherwise, you know, they're going to enlarge whilst inside someone, which is not going to be a pretty sight. Yes, they get out. The crew all get out. But the ship remains are still in there. Now, we know that the human body's cells like had attacked it, so it's suggested that maybe that tries to dissolve them. But every one of those little cells of the construction of that ship would suddenly enlarge. So the shrapnel should just start exploding out from his body. So he rewrote it that they then managed to get the white blood cells to follow them to the eye, so the whole thing comes out. In addition, he also said there's also the subject of the fluid that's used in the syringe that is shrunk down. Because this now means that 14 gallons of water is suddenly going to erupt to full size within this scientist's human body at the end of that hour and explode him. And so he corrects that one as well. He works out how to do that. And this is how Asimov thought as a writer, that when he was just doing a cheap novelization of someone else's work, he'd just approach it and just go, no, the science is wrong. This needs to be fixed. I think it'd be interesting to see that version Like, if they do adapt it again, if James Cameron adapt it, it'd be interested to go to Asimov's version of it and take that point of view, because it'll give those extra elements. It'll give that extra scientific basis.
Where can we find Fantastic Voyage if that's the film we should be watching?
Hard to find on digital at the moment. You can purchase it on digital from a few of the services, but you might as well spend £10, go onto Amazon, buy the Blu-ray, because it's crisp, it's restored, it looks good. It looks so good. Treat yourself. Pick up the Blu-ray of it.
We'll be back next week with another deep dive. And now it's time for this week's reviews. So Andy, get things rolling. Tell us about the film that you Q&A'd this week, which is Sweet Caroline.
She would have been the first female ever to win in a Mary division.
It was clear that other growers were scared of Caroline beating them. We set out to follow Caroline on her journey to Shepton Manor. How were we to know what we were getting ourselves into?
They took my vegetables.
This is my crime scene, sir.
People don't expect private detectives to be funny.
What do you mean you've been shot?
I can't believe you shot me!
How are we doing back there, Willie?
Soil's very dry, Caroline.
I'm quite a big cheese on these encrypted forums.
For all we know, Florence and Louise could be dead now!
Oh, come on!
Look at the growth on that. Call him Ricky Hatton because he's a fighter. I wanted to call it Marilyn Monroe, but...
She doesn't even box.
Yeah.
Who sent you?
I got him into this mess, Paul, and I'm going to get him out of it.
Let it go, Caroline! Let it go!
Yeah, I think in hindsight, we probably should have called the police at that stage.
This first-time feature from co-directors Brooke Driver and Finn Bruce, written by Driver, is a British mockumentary set in the competitive world of vegetable-growing competitions, in which suspicions of cheating and foul play taking place leads to an escalation of events which lead to political corruption, kidnapping, and attempted murder. If all that sounds a little crazy, well, it is, and joyously so. Caroline, played by the ever-excellent Joe Hartley, finds herself disqualified from a marrow-growing competition due to a claimed imperfection in the marrow. Believing that the judging panel were paid off, when her next batch of marrows are stolen, she hires a pair of swinging detectives, detectives who host swinging parties, played by Aisling Bea and Ray Fernan, to investigate. Whilst her close friends, Paul, played wonderfully by Richard Lumsden, a conspiracy nut who fears every knock on the door will be the TV license people, and Willie, played by Celine Jones, a neighbour who caught the theft on camera, help Caroline uncover the truth of the events. As the film plays out, the events spiral further and further out of control in hilariously unpredictable ways. The false documentary style here works so well, and there's a clear inspiration from the marvellous works of Christopher Guest with films such as Best in Show. Similar to those films that came before, in here we have a wide array of eccentric characters that surround the lead, who provide the sometimes bizarre, sometimes subtle humour, whilst Hartley as Caroline gets to mostly play things straight, and even adds in touches of emotional drama at times, with a stellar performance that makes it impossible to not care for Caroline's simple struggle. Right from the start, as the documentary filmmaker introduces the setup, the comedy nerve is given a nudge with a cutaway to a couple of her friends who are going to help on the film, who we are then assured won't be appearing in the rest of it. And that set me chuckling right off the bat, and I barely stopped chuckling throughout the film. The sharp humour of the screenplay is aided by the cast delivering it, and a few moments of inspired improvisation land equally well, making for one of those films that you occasionally find yourself giggling so much that you miss the next few lines, ensuring that there's going to be a repeat viewing sometime soon. Lumsden, as Paul in particular, steals some of the best laughs, with his obsession with conspiracies regularly being proven wrong in the most deftly hilarious manners. Some quick cutaways to random background characters add to the mix to make certain that every opportunity for a chuckle is taken. Running at just over an hour and a half, it feels tight, it feels fun, and it never drags. By the end of the film, I wasn't entirely sure what the heck had just transpired, but I did know that I enjoyed every moment of it. Even the opening title sequence, which was an overproduced bombastic barrage of music and visuals in an almost brass eye-like manner, was inspired brilliance of comedy. The end result is a much-needed breath of comedy fresh air from the British market, and indeed one of the funniest films I've seen in general over the past few years. well and truly recommended for a good time, especially if you see it with a packed audience at a cinema. Sweet Caroline is the pick of the week. Catch it while you can at the cinemas.
Our next review, well, it's this week's big hitter. Let's talk about Abigail.
Hi, I'm Abigail.
We kidnapped a vampire.
You've made a mistake.
Hello?
This is just a game to her.
You're really good at pretending to be a little girl.
Thank you. I've had a few centuries of experience.
We talked earlier about M. Night Shyamalan's new trailer for Trap, how the trailer may have away some of the plot points, and the trailer for Abigail certainly does give away the big reveal of this film. But I think this film went in a direction that neither you and I thought it was going to go in.
If you've seen the trailer for this, you know that it's a group of kidnappers kidnap a girl, and then it turns out the girl is a vampire and starts stalking them around the house. The way that the film plays, because the first act, it's what I consider as like a Dusk Till Dawn kind of approach. That it feels like one kind of film at the start. It's a kidnap plot that they're waiting for a ransom to come in. But then all of a sudden, it flips to be a completely different film at the midpoint. And it feels like it was structured that way. But by knowing that she's going to flip to be a vampire, it kind of takes away a bit of that element of like, oh, where's this going? Because you know at some point it's going to happen. But I don't think it damaged the film, because it then really starts to play around with concepts. And this is something that Radio Silence do so well, because they wear their influences from horrors that they've loved through the years on their sleeves. They did it with Ready or Not. They did it with the Scream franchise. And they're doing it here, that they clearly love the genre that they're playing in. And they want to spin your expectations of what normally happens, but flip it and have fun with it. And how they do that is by packing out a myriad of great names in great roles as the cast that you're going to be focusing on. And this is no exception.
Yes, in the lead, you've got Melissa Barrera, plays a medic. You've got Frank, Dan Stevens, an ex-cop. You've got a hacker, Sammy, played by the great Catherine Newton, who I thought was going to be underused, but he's used absolutely perfectly in this. Got Kevin Durand, William Cartlett as an ex-military man, and the wheelman played by the late Angus Cloud. There is enough going on within the interrelationships of the gang, let alone throwing a little girl into it who just happens to be a vampire who's playing her own game. We had such a good time with this. It's a visceral film. There are horrific elements to it. There are moments in the film when you laugh out loud. I mean, ridiculously laugh out loud. But none of it feels as though it's sending up the genre at any point. The genre, the vampire genre, is played to its hilt. Reinvents a couple of elements. There's an interesting take on who this Kaiser Soze kind of character is. And once you've deduced who that is, then it brings an interesting slant to the rest of the film. But it's just a great schlocky, which once would have been a B-movie, but with great effects, a great set, and some great set pieces.
You've mentioned the primary cast in there. Melissa Barrera is great in this kind of role. She leads it front and center.
It's my first outing with her, because I didn't see Scream, so this is the first time I've been introduced to her.
Absolutely love what she brings to it. I always love Dan Stevens. Even in weaker films, he's always stands out. I mean, recently we saw him in Godzilla X Kong. And I wanted a whole film just with Dan Stevens as a vet to these giant monsters. I think there's a whole story to be told there. But he just brought an energy to that film. And in this one, he's untrustworthy. But is he necessarily untrustworthy for the right reasons or the wrong reasons? You can't quite get a handle on him, because all of these characters have all been brought together and they're all anonymous to each other, and they need to remain anonymous. So they don't know who each other are. And it creates this aura of mistrust around this group who are also trying to bond at the same time. Like you say, Kevin Durand, absolutely magnificent as always. He's one of the best character actors that we have around. Catherine Newton, we've loved Catherine Newton. I've loved her right from her popping up for the first time all those years ago in Paranormal Activity 4. I believe it was.
My introduction was Map of
Tiny Perfect Things, which I insisted that Lee watch, saying that he's going to love it. She's such a great actress. But let's be honest here. The true star of this film is Alicia Weir playing young Abigail. Child actors, in horror films in particular, will make or break the film. And a lot of the times, a child actor underperforms and basically makes you not care for events because you just want the child character to die. She is mesmerizing. She is funny. She is terrifying. And she is sinister. She's magnificent in this role. And whenever she's on screen, particularly when she's interacting with Melissa Barrera's Joey character, that's when the magic of this film really hits.
And of course, what we're going to have is going to have a brand new horror character cosplay, because it's such a simple idea. A little girl covered in blood in a ballerina costume. And we're going to be seeing a lot more of that. This is a great ride. This is my kind of horror film. It's funny. It's dark in the right places. It pushes the genre just a little bit. It's messy. I just had a lot of fun, and it was still scary in the right places. Love this film. Hope it does well. And I'd like to see the character again. Now I know whose daughter she is.
Yes, it gets a complete thumbs up from me.
A bloody one at that.
A bloody thumbs up. If you love your screams and scares, your bloodbaths, but with a dose of comedy and humour throughout, this is definitely, definitely one to check out.
And our final review for this week is...
Sometimes I Think About Dying.
Remember the...
What do you call a sour coffee? Espresso.
You're funny.
Do you have plans tonight?
So did you like the movie?
I didn't really like anything about that movie.
What do you like?
My job.
What about it?
I'm good at it. Remember. Tell me something about you.
Got divorced. I guess I can't seem to figure it out.
Figure one out?
Love.
Fran, played by Daisy Ridley, is a painfully introverted worker in an office environment who starts to connect with a newcomer to the office, all the while her own social awkwardness building walls to prevent her from getting too close, in this lightly comedic drama from Rachel Lambert. Surrounded by other workers who are more than comfortable with the typical social small talk engagements that go on in life, no matter how otherwise embarrassing most of that chatter would be, Fran's life in her cubicle is one of silence and as little human engagement as she can manage to get away with, instead spending her time poring over spreadsheets and daydreaming of isolation through death. She isn't actively depressed or suicidal. She just longs for the isolated solitude of being dead in a forest or on a piece of flotsam on a beach somewhere where nobody can find her. But the entering presence of David Mergy as Robert threatens to draw Fran out of herself for the first time and starts her struggle with being comfortable enough with herself to be comfortable enough with another person. Anyone who has any degree of social anxiety and awkwardness will absolutely identify with Fran here. And those who have no personal experience of it will hopefully see from this film that those who seem weird and quiet are not deliberately distant. They just don't know what to say and somewhat overthink things too much in fear of ridicule. This is demonstrated early on in the film when Fran is asked to write something on the card of a co-worker who's leaving, scanning over the passages and witty messages made by others, contemplating what to add before writing a simple, happy retirement instead. The sentiment is right, but the fear of saying the wrong thing forces Fran to take the safe option. Ridley, as Fran, is an absolute marvel here. And without much dialogue, indeed, for around the first 20 minutes, she doesn't utter a single word as those around her chatter incessantly about trivial things. She draws us in to the essence of who Fran is. There's no malice, no hatred of the world around her, just simple awkwardness that makes her remain in her comfort zone of silence. It's only when she unexpectedly connects with Robert, initially via office desktop chat exchanges about ordering supplies, that Fran starts to think about opening up, although she then struggles with knowing what to open up about that would sound interesting. It's a wonderfully melancholic approach that is complemented by a visual approach to the filmmaking, with some shots being majorly off-centre in the framing, the pair of characters pushed to the lower corner of the screen, with barely anything of interest dominating the frame, itself capturing the isolated nature of introverts, asking you to look away as we stumble to fit in. It's a smart visual choice that really connects with the essence of who Fran is. Charming, melancholic, sometimes witty, and absolutely relatable to so many of us. Sometimes I Think About Dying shines a spotlight on what it means to be introverted and the fight to be allowed to not have to engage in small talk, with a central performance that shows that Ridley is a much better actor than the toxic fandom online want to believe. Well and truly recommended viewing.
That's the films for this week, but what's coming up over the next week?
So at cinemas, it's quite a busy week of a mixed variety of films. There's Ordinary Angels, there's Challengers, which I've got on my radar to watch.
Yeah, I've heard good things about it.
The Spy X Family Code White. Yes, it's another anime getting given a cinema release. ISS lands this week. American Society of Magical Negroes lands this week on a limited UK release. The one that I definitely want to see is Boy Kills World. I talked about this when the trailer landed. It looks like a lot of fun. That opens this coming week. On Now TV and Sky, one to avoid is Strays, the film about the talking dogs that no one needs to see. There's The Lesson and there's The Starling Girl. And on Netflix, In the Land of Saints and Sinners lands, and TV series Dead Boy Detectives drops, which we're kind of interested in because, well, the Neil Gaiman aspect obviously brings us along for that ride.
And that, folks, well, that's it for this week. Another film file over and done. But before we go, it's our neat things. Things that we've enjoyed. Things that we think we should share. Andy, what do you want to share?
I've been over on YouTube this week and I fell into a rabbit hole. We were talking about retro gaming last week when you were talking about going to the Retro Gaming Museum.
Oh, yeah.
And that got me digging down a rabbit hole of retro gaming channels because I'm so easily influenced. And one of the channels that I came across, and I say I was easily influenced, and it ties in neatly, because Rose Tinted Spectrum on YouTube has been going through episodes over the past few years of the 90s TV series for kids, Bad Influence, which was a hip and cool video game reviews and like look at like the environment of video games with Andy Crane and Violet Berlin. And what he's done is he's taking each of the episodes and he's clipping it down to like 10 minutes of highlights and does a commentary over the top that is hilarious, mocking this show for everything that it did in a, I used to love this, but this hasn't held up well kind of way. And it's a joy to watch, even if you've never seen any of the episodes of Bad Influence. So it was never any like anything heartfelt to you. It's so much fun for how he mocks it because Bad Influence had so many things that it thought was cool at the time. It starts calling good things, that's Jurassic. What? When has that ever been a term? And then on the fourth episode, they say, this is totally Triassic. It's like, are we going to the Cretaceous period as well? I'm not sure what this means. They had the kids playing the games and reviewing them.
I remember that. Now you've mentioned it, yes.
Some of them are hilariously bad and so bland. But there's a beautiful one, I think it's on like the sixth episode, when they're talking about an Indiana Jones game that got released on the Mega Drive that was terrible. And like he pauses it and he just says, like, this game was terrible. Please tell me that you don't like it. And the kid who criticizes it shreds the game. He absolutely lays into it. And he's like, whoa, this guy's on fire. It's well worth watching. The little 10 to 12 minute episodes of Breaking Bad Influence. And he's covered all four seasons over the years. And they're just so much fun because you get the nostalgic memories of the games that are getting covered, but you also have the fun at realizing how basically a show made by adults trying to be hip and cool with the kids was missing the mark completely. Breaking Bad Influence from Rose Tinted Spectrum. He also covers on his channel loads of other retro gaming stuff, as well as the Nightmare TV series that some of us fondly remember from around the same era. He does exactly the same thing in there. It's a great channel to check out. It's particularly if you like old video games or old TV shows. I'm down that rabbit hole and I'm not getting out.
Does he cover Games Master as part of that?
Not yet. He has mentioned it in some of his other videos. I'd love him to go through Games Master at some point.
In fact, I was on a couple of episodes of Games Master. I'm not going to tell you who I played, but I was on it. And that's where I met Dexter Fletcher and hung out back in the day. Wait and see. Let me know. For me, it's a new album. I'm always happy when That's something new to listen to. And I am really enjoying the heck out of the new album by Gunn. Gunn are a Scottish rock band. They burst into the scene way back in 1987, probably most famously with their rocked up version of the dance hit Word Up, originally by Cameo. And I've never really gone away. Change of singer, couple of changes of lineup. But back in 1987, they felt raw and they felt fresh, especially after the big rock bands of the 80s. Their new album, Hombre, is probably their freshest and the best Gunn album that they've turned out in an awful long time. All that pandemic frustration plays out in this record, and I just can't stop listening to it. They write rock songs which are heavy, but never miss having a great sing-along chorus. They're not reinventing the wheel, but what they're doing now makes them feel so fresh. If you're a fan of rock music and you're thinking, there's not much that I can call classic these days, highly recommend Hombre's, the new album by Scottish band Gunn. Get your ears around that one. And that, folks, that's us done. We're out of here. Thank you, as ever, for joining us. And remember, tell all your friends, get more people on site to become part of the Film File family, because that's what family's all about. It's all about caring and sharing. Andy, hopefully I'll see you in the week.
Yep, hopefully we'll get to catch another film. We're doing well at the moment. We're kind of seeing a film together each week. This doesn't happen. So one of us is going to fall dreadfully ill. I mean, to be fair, this week, Lee did fall dreadfully asleep on the night that we were supposed to be watching Abigail. I'd locked up at work, everyone had gone, and I was still waiting for Lee to turn up so we could watch this film. And
I was fast out.
I got a message off him saying, shit, fell asleep.
I was so
we rescheduled for the following night.
And it made it better, made it more fun.
Yeah, because you double billed. Yeah, you did Civil War and then hung around to watch Abigail. So, I'm so glad that you enjoyed Civil War the same way that I did. Because
really blew me away.
There's a handful of people who are not getting it because they wanted the Civil War explaining. They wanted to know why it happened. It's like, but that's not the story. That's not what's important.
And that was its strength for me. That was what made it a unique piece of cinema. Yeah. Because I'm still thinking about it now. I'm still trying to figure it out. And it's left an impression.
Yeah.
We'll be back again next week. But in the meantime, yet all the suns that light the corridors of the universe shine before the blazing of a single thought.